This week on Think Twice, we feature Hanif Abdurraqib, widely known for his music writing and for uniquely blending history, criticism, and prose in books such as 2021's A Little Devil in America, his first full-length poetry collection, The Crown Ain't Worth Much, was published in 2016. His second, A Fortune for Your Disaster, was published in 2019 and won the esteemed Lenore Marshall Prize in 2020. Today's audio was captured September 30th, 2025, as part of the current schedule of performances at the Foundry Theater at Antioch College in Yellow Springs. It begins with an introduction by Chris Westhoff, director of the Foundry Theater and managing director of Mad River Theater Works.
A lot of cool things happen in a little village, and one of them is you get to know new people, and I'm really proud to introduce to you from the village, originally from Columbus, growing up in some poetry circles, knowing Hanif, now working at our very own Home Inc. as the outreach and fundraising manager. If you would, please make welcome Alex Scott.
Hi, everybody. I'm not a memorizer, so forgive me. I have paper. Thanks for being here. I've known Hanif since he ran a Thursday night open mic at a coffee shop in the Short North, and I was an awkward teenager enjoying one of my earliest experiences of true community and support. I did grow up in Columbus before I moved here in 2012, and one thing that really always amazed me about Columbus is that the city seems to have like a soul. And that's not something that you find in the buildings or the highways. It's in the people and the way that they treat each other and the beauty that they put into the world. And when I think about the things that I love about Columbus, I think about Hanif. He really embodies the heart and soul of the city, and he holds the city with a reverence and a compassion that really, when you see it, it fills your heart. For as long as I can remember, Hanif's been a role model and an inspiration in so many ways. He has a deep knowledge and a love of music. It's virtually unmatched. He has an amazing way with words and imagery. His writing, whether it's spoken or read, whether it's poetry, essays, nonfiction, it really has a way of sucking you right in and transporting you somewhere else, even if you've never been there. He really explores topics like pop culture, music, love, and race with this depth of knowledge and observation of not just somebody who has read about it, not just somebody who was there, but who breathes it, whose heart beats it with every breath. He can take things that are sometimes overlooked, ignored, taken for granted, and he polishes them into gold for the world to see with a new light. I know he said maybe less of the basic bio stuff, so I'll make this part quick. But he said, Hanif, he's a great poet, a cultural critic, and an essayist. He has two collections of poetry, The Crown Ain't Worth Much and A Fortune for Your Disaster, and his poems have been published in a number of journals, including Muzzle and Pan American. His music criticism and essays have been published in Pitchfork, The New Yorker, The Fader, and New York Times. Other works include They Can't Kill Us Until They Kill Us, a collection of essays that was named 2017 Book of the Year by BuzzFeed, Esquire, NPR, Oprah Magazine, Paste, CBC, The Los Angeles Review, Pitchfork, The Chicago Tribune, and more. Seriously, if you haven't got that book, you have to go get it. You have to check it out. It's amazing. Go Ahead in the Rain, Notes to a Tribe Called Quest. They do have that out there. It's a New York Times bestseller. It was longlisted for the National Book Award. Oh, wait, they don't have Go Ahead in the Rain. They have A Little Devil in America, which is also amazing. That's a Praise of Black Performance, National Book Award finalist, and the 2022 Andrew Carnegie Medal for Excellence, as well as the Gordon Byrne Prize. And last year, which they also have this book out there, he released There's Always This Year, on Basketball and Ascension, another New York Times bestseller that also won the National Book Critics Circle Award. Hanif's work has gained such critical acclaim, the list of awards and praises he has rightfully earned is longer than the time that I actually have for this introduction, and he deserves more than that. Suffice to say that you can believe me when I tell you that you're in for a treat. So without much further ado, the amazing author, the king of Fall Out Boy references, the guy with the amazing shoes, my friend, Hanif Abdurraqib.
Thanks, Alex.
That's such a great, that was very touching to hear. You know, I started an open mic at a, first off, thank y'all for coming. It's good to be here. I started that open mic at a coffee house that was at the time called Trivana, then became Fifth Avenue Coffee House, and now it's like a pizza place. Or a bakery, a vegan bakery, maybe? I don't know. I'm never in the short north because that's where, like, it's just, like, not where black people are anymore, quite frankly. I was trying to think of a nice way to say that, and it's like, no, there's just no real black people there anymore. But I started that open mic only because I had never written poems at the time. I hadn't written my first poem yet, and I was in this coffee shop writing late every night because I was writing, like, music reviews for local papers. And the guy who ran it at the time was like, you're in here writing. At the time, it was open 24 hours, so I was in there like 1 a.m. writing. And he was like, you want to host a poetry open mic? And I was like, sure, how hard can it be? You know? I've never written a poem. I don't really know what a poem is, but yeah, I just show up with a microphone, people will come. That's not how it went at all. But after a while, people did come, and Alex was one of those people, and her mother Karen was one of those people, and it was really beautiful to build this small community out of nothing, and that without that community, I don't think I would have kept writing poems, and so I owe Alex a great debt. Thank you all for coming tonight. Here's how this is going to go as I envision it in my head. I'm going to read a thing out of There's Always This Year, which is a book that I wrote that came out last year, and then I'm going to read some poems that are really new that no one's heard. Is that cool? The thing about There's Always This Year that is funny to me is that basketball people actually like it, which is so funny because when the book first came out, I feel like people will never admit this now, but when the book first came out, the vibe was like, no one who loves basketball is going to love this book. The general consensus is like basketball people, capital B, capital P, basketball people are going to look at this and be like, I can't, I'm not following. But the way that this book has become a universe unto itself in the world of basketball has been great because I, as a basketball fan, wanted basketball people to like this book. And, you know, as we roll into a new NBA season, I don't know if anyone here is a WNBA fan, but what a day. What a day for the WNBA, huh? I love Nafisa Collier. Like, actually and truly, deeply have a lot of affection for Nafisa Collier. And I promise I'm going to read and not just yap about basketball, but how cool is it to have, like, one of the most popular players in the whole sport of basketball be like, y'all, my boss sucks, and I hate her. In public, you know what I mean? Like, not, you know, how often have you had a job and you just been like, man, everything about the ownership of this place sucks, but you can't really say it, and Nafisa Collier got on that microphone in front of the whole world and was like, this is terrible. And then every other player in the league was like, yes, actually, I can relate. So, bad day to be the WNBA commissioner because she is finding out exactly how much everyone hates her. There were years before the fences crowned with barbed wire, years before the monochromatic manufacturing plants began to sprawl, before concrete was poured over the grass, over the highest shouts of the yellow flowers, before the parking lots and the cars flooding the lots so tightly one could barely walk among them. Mostly, though, it was a time before the simplest, most mundane pleasures could be governed by fear. And in those years, when I was still young, my father would take my brother and me to a field that pushed right up against the airport. It is hard to imagine now, because of all the aforementioned architecture designed to keep people away, or at least keep people with idle time and idle intentions away, but you could walk right up to the airport in those days. The Greenbrier housing projects were next to it, and our complex was just down the street. We'd drive, but if one wanted to, one could, in fact, walk straight onto the field, sit in the tall grass, lean back among the flowers, and watch the planes take off. We'd always go at sunset, mostly on Fridays after my father got off work. It was one of the rare times with my father father that demanded silence, no speaking, no music pushing the limits of stereo speakers in a car or living room. You were so close to the runways at the airport, you could feel the ground tremble when a plane was preparing to take off. That is how you knew to look up. The soil would jump slightly, brown specks spilling over onto the brown hand pushed against the earth, and then moments later, the reveal. From behind the airport building or a single tower interrupting the sky, a plane would emerge, the front of it tilting back, a mouth drinking in the sun's final offerings, brightness collapsing atop another more alarming brightness, a metal machine, large and loud at first and then smaller, smaller, silent, gone. And at that age, I never thought there were people inside of the planes. I never imagined anyone leaving anywhere or who they might be leaving behind. It all just seemed like a show, no different than the explosion of fireworks, temporary decorations before the sky went black. Would it help here for me to tell you that my father was a man who left one place to make a home someplace else, New Jersey, and then New York, and then Ohio? He and my mother and my two older siblings left and came to Columbus because that's where adults could find jobs. Migration is sometimes a requirement, an act of survival. I never thought of my father as longing for a return to anywhere, which is, of course, what a child believes, even while sitting beside a man who has made a ritual of silence, a man who made a ritual of looking up and watching planes take people from the place he was to any place he wasn't. But let us dwell on heartbreak and its subplots for a moment. For example, I would like to examine the admittedly childish impulse that exists when seeing an ex anything in the throes of a new pleasure, a pleasure that you do not have access to, one that you could not provide for them, and even the pleasure that they left you to seek. I don't mind bumping into an ex at the movies or while fumbling through the towels or toiletries at Target. In a small enough city, it happens, and with enough heartbreaks, every city can become a small enough city. We can make our small talk and keep it moving, or, depending on the circumstances, one can quietly slip a couple aisles over and remain extremely still, hoping that we weren't spotted and hoping that our ex-beloved does not require any of the goods in the aisle we've stumbled into. But where I've struggled mightily is in the feeling that comes with knowing someone I loved once and maybe still loves, enjoying a life with someone else. And yet, even struggling with this and knowing very clearly that I do not wish to be the shepherd dragging myself from my own devastation, I still, like you, probably, I say probably because while loneliness is not at all a crime, I do not wish to be alone here. I have indeed, like you, reached for my phone on a night when no one else will return my texts, on a night where my dull and understated flirtations have gone underappreciated and without reciprocation. And yes, I have opened Instagram and made my way to the page of a person I miss. I do this in part with the hope that they are missing me wherever they are, that they have littered their Instagram stories with sad songs and dull photos of the sky, meals for one, walks through the doldrums of winter, leaving behind only one set of footprints. This is a shaky proposition, of course, even shakier when greeted with your old person living a new and joyful life, one that looks unfamiliar to the one you burden them with, you fool. And yes, a new cast of characters has emerged. None of them you, all of them probably cooler, probably better looking, most likely laughing at you in this very moment. I am unsure why any of us would pursue this. The anxiety of scrolling through our past, though lightly, of course, so as not to trigger any dreaded accidental liking of a week's old photo or even months old, depending on exactly how down bad you might be. I'm going to take a break here to say that the key to this is understanding the frequency with which someone posts. If you are like I'm not really an Instagram grid scroller now, because once this whole section was born out of the fact that in like 2019, I was scrolling an ex's Instagram and accidentally liked a months old photo because she only posts like 3 times a year. You know what I mean? So it's like one of those things. You just got to have an understanding of the frequency with which your ex or crush or whatever. You just don't want to end up in a situation. Nothing wrong with liking a days old post. We get it. We've all been there. But when you start getting back into like seasons of a life that have passed, that you were not a part of, then we get in the category of like restraining order being drafted, you feel me? And so just, you know, I figured I would take a detour there to drop a lesson on you all. Don't be like me in 2019. Not that there was a restraining order drafted. She just texted me and was like, are you okay? And I said, funny you should ask, no. It doesn't make sense to me, even in the rare times I find myself doing it. I believe what I'm chasing probably is a type of certainty, closure beyond closure, preparation for what I might say if I were to ever see my old person or old people out with their new person or new people. The ache is, of course, not exclusive to the romantic relationship. I have found it harder, even when it comes to the platonic relationship, which, when done correctly, is also a romantic relationship. And this, I think, leads to the greater question I will pose to whatever angel is behind the layered concept of this specific brand of anguish. There is sometimes a thinning of the portal between wanting someone gone and wanting them back. I have found this to be the worst of times, I must admit. Longing in its most vicious hours, laughing its way past your lonely windows, your empty couch, the side of the bed that was not always only your side, the basketball court where you shoot alone now. I am afraid of what getting under the hood of this moment will reveal about my own messes, the ones of my past and the ones that are surely on the horizon, as I don't learn from my heartbreaks as much as I learn to catalog them, to pull them from their cases and admire them with a type of fascination for a while before locking them away again. But I imagine it much like the sweetness of seasons, if you live anywhere that has seasons arriving harshly, seasons that fight their way toward the exit, kicking and shouting one last torrent of cold or stifling humidity. The worst of Ohio's winters often comes in their final act, and it's especially vicious because within the otherwise seemingly endless scroll of gray days adorned with ice and wind, there might be a day or a few hours of absolutely perfect weather, spring twirling out from behind the gray for a brief audition just to check and see if it still got it, and it still does, and you might for a moment remember that this is what it was like, this is what it was like when it was good, back before so many of us were emptied and left numb at the frozen and monotonous gates of winter. I am of a particular emotional makeup, and because of this, I believe that misery does not need company as much as I believe that misery is company, damn good company too if you can get it on. Honest enough, by this I mean I get it. The sun dances from beneath the gray and I want the warmth. The trees are trying to fight back to life and I root for them. But then I think, what will become of this misery I've held, that I've kept for myself, that I've made my own? I know my way around this. I want to keep the familiar as much as I want to run toward whatever newness arrives. I want to wallow in the memory, in the reality of what I know, what can only hurt me as much as I allow it to. It bears mentioning that I come from a place people leave. Yes, when LeBron left, the reactions made enough sense to me, I suppose, but there was a part of me that felt entirely unsurprised. People leave this place. There are Midwestern states that are far less discernible on a blank map. Sure, even with an understanding of direction, I am known to fuck up the order of the Dakotas. I've been known to point at a great many square-like landscapes while weakly mumbling, Nebraska? And so I get it. We don't have it too bad. People at least claim to know that Ohio is shaped like a heart, a jagged heart, a heart with sharp edges, a heart as a weapon. That's why so many people make their way elsewhere. At the end of high school, my crew was one of a small handful that decided to stick around to go to one of the small colleges or the very big university that engulfs our city. Most everyone else charted a path out, laughed at their graduation parties when folks suggested that they'd see them when they came back to visit. Most everyone I fell in love with in this city spent nights looking at maps, scrolling through apartment options in other cities. There was always the foregone conclusion. Our affections didn't have to be temporary, but our proximity did. They would leave and we'd figure it out, or we wouldn't. I'm accustomed to the physical act of leaving and being left behind. I love a long, aimless road trip for how it flirts with the act of leaving but never fully commits. You get to try on the outfits of different sunrises through a car window for however long you want, and then return to the familiar colors of where you are, where your things are, where your people are, until they decide to make their exit for good. There are places where people make it and places where people make it out of. It seems there are far more of the latter than there are of the former. Every place has its limits, how much it can grow, what of its population it can reasonably swallow in the name of that growth. But still, there are the places people live in until they become the person who can survive somewhere better. And by 2010, too many of my friends were in different time zones. We'd promise to catch up and then never do it. We'd visit each other twice a year, and then once, and then not at all. When the heart breaks slowly, gradually, in a way that seems almost inevitable, you can barely even notice it. It happens in a small series of whispers, and then one day there is a corner of it that sighs to pieces while you box up a photo or donate a bag of old clothes. And this is to say nothing of that other type of leaving. For all there is to be made about a chorus of pleading, of shouts, of insistent and entitled lovers and ex-lovers fighting amongst each other for a stitch of mercy, some way to rewind and undo the damage of past collision, That is a privilege of knowing leaving is not permanent. And when it is permanent, the only audience for all that moaning is God, who, despite an alleged track record of miracles, has no interest in pardoning grief through resurrection, and who, I imagine, grows weary of the unbearable questioning shouted out, piercing the middle of a night. No one likes to imagine God needing rest, but then again, it's impossible to fathom any being required to love that many people who are still living, still teeming with questions and demands. Yes, the permanence of leaving is hard to reckon with, but I suppose I love the dead in part because they are no longer here to ask anything of me, to be dissatisfied with who I've become. There's a mercy in that, though I would take at least some of my beloveds back across the threshold of the living if I could. I love the dead, too, because I have no choice, because there are so many of them, because in the spring of 2011, when the Cavs were not winning a damn thing, I buried Cam's ashes under a sycamore tree in Cleveland, which I only knew was a sycamore tree because of how Cam would sometimes point to a tree that looked like it and then point to a scar running across the side of his arm, curved sharply like a wicked grin, and he'd say, "Sycamore tree f***ed me up when I was a kid." And so it was decided, bury him at the feet of his one true enemy, and maybe he'd grow again there, grow into something bigger and taller, something too big and too tall to die in this lifetime or any of the next ones. I love the dead who have made fools of time, the elders who smoked two packs a day right up into the middle of their ninth decade, who survived and survived out of pure spite. There's a type of leaving that some might celebrate with a laugh, a shrug, a "can you believe this fool" pitch across a funeral service, but I too love the dead who decided that the world was simply not tenable for them, or who had that decided for them, who weighed the cost of suffering with how long they'd be able to survive it and chose the math that bought them the most peace. I love you all too. I'm not mad at you anymore, I promise. I am past inventing you into enemies. I am sorry. I was selfish once. I wanted to feel nothing if I could not feel the world alongside your living selves. I am no longer cursing your names into pillows. I am no longer cursing the clothes you left in the corners of my apartments where I let them collect dust. I love the dead because we cannot let each other down anymore. I cannot fail you. I am thankful for a leaving that is permanent. It is one thing to be haunted by a life gone, and another to be haunted by a life that spins on happily without you.
You're listening to Think Twice on WYSO. Today featuring Poetry in Conversation with Hanif Abdurraqib. His latest collection of poetry is titled A Fortune for Your Disaster. We will return after these messages. Welcome back to Think Twice. We return to today's program, which features Hanif Abdurraqib, recorded at the Foundry Theater in Yellow Springs in September of last year.
I'm going to read a poem that takes a title from the English translation of Nana's 99 Lift Balloons. The poem is called There's Something Here from Somewhere Else. I would prefer a different night sky from where I sit, more terror and less eager to be perceived. I would prefer to not have the velocity of my yearning hitched to lamps flickering across the boundless hem of a dark dress, but here I am. I miss you in decades, and I miss you in minutes. I miss you in miles, in the inches of a moth's wing. I pulled the Black Earth Crisis shirt you left behind from the back of my closet, and it was riddled with small holes. Cruel and punishing galaxy. The trick is that you leave once, but the taking never stops. An astronaut told me the moment he left Earth's atmosphere, he understood how fragile he was. He told me, I realize the heart does not require us as much as we require it, which I took to mean, without the arrogance afforded to us by gravity, we are useless planets, sustained by unpredictable mercies, choir directors shouting over singers with their backs turned, singing a song you did not ask for. A group of moths is called an eclipse, and there's a terror I was after. Even light gets an eviction notice. Even memory has a landlord. Our sorrow isn't special, and neither are our saviors. Your mother told us that if we closed our eyes and pressed hard enough, we would see stars everywhere. It turns out swans don't make any noise that could be considered a song. I'll believe anything from the mouth of a child in the year where they learn wonder but have not yet learned cruelty. Faith strangled by the off-key groan of an untuned instrument becomes delusion. I plant my flag in that sound, in the moments when two hands are pressed together in prayer with such violence that the edges of the palms turn white. Blood surrenders to the demands of the mind, the life you would exchange for your own, the death of whatever lives in your heart that stops you from killing. My pal's young daughter never heard her dead father speak and says she can hear his voice in her dreams, and it is sharp and urgent like the hiss of a light bulb in the second before it explodes. And I love how the notes of an out-of-tune piano sound like a warning. I love how the piano, too, suffers from a lack of touch and then makes itself unapproachable. It is a territorial animal, does whatever it takes to stay a little bit longer, wants to live more than it wants you to die. It is actually very true that swans don't make a sound that's like a song. They make a very horrible hissing sound. It's like atrocious. I learned this because my friend, who's going to become a theme, who's going to be like a sub-theme of these next few poems, is a person who studies like insects and animals. I don't know what that kind of scientist is. Entomologist, yes. And at a friend's wedding 2 years ago, I made at a bachelorette party that I got invited to, because I guess I'm one of those guys who gets invited to the bachelorette party. You know, I'm a feminist, you know what I mean? Oh, I was someone like, thank you for seriously cheering. I was being both earnest and intentionally silly. But thank you, yes, I am. There's no good way to land that plane, you know what I mean? Like, once you're like, oh, I was joking, but seriously, I'm not. But I was like, oh, I made some swan song comment, and she was like, have you heard what swans actually sound like? And we're at like a club at 2 a.m, and she's pulling out her phone, and we're all leaning in close to hear these horrible screeching sound. So next time someone says a swan song thing, you can be like, you know what? Do I have news for you? Swans sound horrible. To speak of that friend, so I don't know how bad the lantern flies are out here, but in Columbus they're very bad. They're everywhere, and I had to get a tree cut down in my backyard. Me and all my neighbors, we had to get like a whole section of trees cut down because the lantern flies had invaded. And we had, you know, because I'm in a community of people I love and care about, we had like a neighborhood meeting about this, and we were like, if we can't save most of the trees, we just gotta let them go. And it was very devastating for all of us. And the person who came to cut down my tree was this man who said this thing to me that was like, this tree has to go. And I said, for sure, yeah, I guess. I mean, I'm sad about it, but for sure. And he said, if we don't take this tree, your house could be next. And I was like, well, what do you mean by that? I mean, like, I was looking at the lantern flies. I was like, what are they going to, are they going to gentrify the neighborhood and then I won't be able to afford the lantern flies are like building a kombucha stand in a Starbucks. Imagine a man standing over a tree with a chainsaw saying that very somberly. I was like, you're a poet. You're a dramatic like me. I get it. This is like a part-time gig. You're doing open mics some night. And so I called my friend to mourn this tree, my entomologist friend, and she said this thing that I quote in this poem that sparked this poem. This poem is also called There's Something Here from Somewhere Else. The man standing over the tree in my backyard shakes his head and runs his fingers along the orange handle of a chainsaw while saying, I hate to lose a tree like this, but your house could be next. It isn't the fault of the lantern fly that it ended up here. My scientist pal studies dead insects under microscopes. She texts me photos of butterfly wings with messages that say things like, this pattern looks like the eyes of a baby when they first open. And I text back, what kind of babies have you been around? When I tell her the lantern flies have commandeered the tree in my backyard, she texts, poor things, they did not ask to come here, and now everyone wants them dead. And I am ashamed at the indifference I feel to their suffering. I didn't ask to be born, and you don't see me making a scene about it. You don't see me trimming the green from your garden, poisoning the branches in their leaves, which hang into beams of sunlight like hair over the eyes of your long-gone love. The species of tree in my backyard is the tree of heaven. I did not choose it myself. We didn't choose each other. It was here before me and has survived despite the weakness of the soil, despite the rejections of the earth. It's a shame we can't choose what takes us. My beloved elder fought in 2 wars and smoked a pack a day until he was 95 and slipped on a misplaced newspaper at the top of the nursing home stairs. You perhaps understand the engine of my indifference now. It isn't as if nature cares all that much about what lives and what dies, but I suppose someone has to. Down the street, my neighbor weeps over the dead bird in her yard. On the sidewalk, her young daughter gleefully jumps up and down on an anthill across a table from each other. For the last time, a spotted lanternfly fell between us on its back, legs up and kicking frantically like debris pulled loose in a storm, and you whispered, "Oh, poor lost beauty," and gently flipped it over with your finger. And for a moment, its bewilderment was also my own. I am ashamed at the indifference which keeps me from mercy. I am on my back, staring into the sun, waiting for someone to play God. I suppose, before I get into the new poems, I don't know, I'm not at all opposed to the content warning as a form. I tend to just struggle with how to frame the content warning of these poems. And I read that piece first because I think it'll help me bridge the gap. So much of the new book is about the kind of bewilderment I have at having survived this long. Joyful bewilderment, but bewilderment nonetheless. And a longing for my friends who did not. Aligned with this kind of confusion that I had. And the first poem I'm going to read is going to... I was like a year and a half ago. So I do like a lot of radical political organizing, whatever. And I love those spaces, and also sometimes I think those spaces are, and I can contribute to this, they're kind of overwrought with semantics. That's just a part of it, right? That's the gentlest way I can say that. And there was a point like 2 years ago, a year and a half ago, where I was like, I was naming some American president, and I was like, he's going to hell for sure. Any American president, but like, who knows which one. It's like, he's going to be in hell for sure. And my pal was like, hell is actually not an abolitionist concept. Like, you can't be an abolitionist. And I was like, for sure. But I mean, like, it was one of those moments where I was like, for sure, for sure, for sure. But that means that just everyone's going to heaven, right? If we are to believe in the binary, that means that, like, I gotta be in heaven with, like, Phil Spector, you know what I mean? I would like for him to not hang out with me in heaven. So I began to think about the crisis of my... I was raised Muslim, so I don't really have a connection to, which is funny because so many of the poems are dabbling in biblical mythologies or black spirituals. And I was like, oh, maybe I just don't believe in the concept of heaven or hell, which is also fine with me, but that means that everyone I love, I'm propelled by this idea that everyone I love is somewhere waiting for me to arrive. Everyone I love who's not here is somewhere, and I'm going to reach them. And if I extract that belief from my fundamental core, then that fills me with a sense of dread that I have to work through. And I also have to figure out how to construct a heaven on an earth that is unworthy of it. You feel what I'm saying? And so here are some poems about that, perhaps. That's as good as content warnings I can give. But to open with the poem from which all the other ones were born, this poem's called All the TV Shows Are About Cops. Which is true, in a sense. I stream all my shit like most people, but I also watch sports. And so whenever I'm watching sports, and then it goes to commercial, it's like cop show, cop show, cop show, medic show, where the medics are also kind of cops. Fireman show, where the firemen are moonlighting as cops. Great American Bake Off, everyone gets a gun. All the TV shows are about cops. Miriam says it's unethical to wish a kind of hell on anyone. The desire to punish is unethical. It is not unethical to know suffering. It is maybe unethical to want it for someone who is not you. The killers showed up to the funeral, is all I'm saying. The killers held the hands of the elders during the family prayers, and I listened for the breaking of small bones. That I walk the earth untouched by its fevers and plagues is proof of my good intentions. I wish nothing on anyone that I could not endure myself, which is bad news for both of us. With the fingers of our elders interlocked with the fingers of the killers at the funeral, the pastor sang, "Take my hand, precious Lord." The song was written by a man who watched his wife and child die in the same week and could not believe the ladder did not descend. If it is a question of ethics, I want the Lord to lead you to the home you deserve and nowhere else. And that leaves us with the hell of minor inconvenience, the hell of beauty spilling through the metal bars on a window, the hell of a life so long no one is left to bury you, the hell of a child who calls you by your first name, the hell of a child grown too big for any fear you can invent for them in the hell of the world that has to endure your inventions anyway? What if on your way to heaven there is an animal in the road? And what if the animal won't move? And what if you have one bullet? Who might you become? What ruins can you claim that others might pray to on their path to an eternal life? I understand the conflict of ethics, but the imagination cannot sustain itself without inventing violence for someone else. But let's say I surrender the traditional designs. I surrender the burning and I surrender the weeping. Hell is then the pain you made for someone else. The animals that crowd the path and how they scream and how the sky you crawled towards echoes back the sound of a mother being pulled from a casket she does not want to let go of. A harmony of curses, of nails dragging across oak. My friend's father worked in a factory. He pressed copper into a flat sheet which then wrapped around bullets, and he wept at the sound of gunfire, and he sent flowers to every burial. I forgive him. I forgive him and no one else. This poem is called Sometimes I Laugh When I Think About How the Emails Won't Quit When I'm Gone. The speaker in this poem would be the emailer, not me. In this scenario, I'd be dead. Though not, don't imagine that. Just imagine the speaker being relevant. I'm circling back. I am dancing backwards. I'm the architect of the most decadent sphere. I have reversed time again. I am a child in the sphere's center. My suffering is equidistant from my salvation, the way my face looked in the reflection of the blade which cut the side of my neck the first time I tried to shave. Underneath the filter of blood, no child exists. The limitations of what the eye can measure means there is no such thing as a perfect circle. Your first love kissed your neck and left a circular cloud of red that never changed to anything else. And some would say that makes you less of a child. Have you heard the one about the man who was told by an angel to build a bridge? The angel said he would know where the bridge was going when he got to the end. Have you heard there is no end? Have you heard death is the hand which holds a hammer raised over the nail you believe to be the last one, or death is the next nail after the one you believe to be the last one? The expansiveness of what the heart can endure means there is no such thing as a bridge that ends. Could you offer a sentence or two about the choir? Could you offer a sentence or two about the singer who falls asleep screaming and wakes up screaming? Could you tell me how it feels to watch one note loop around and spill into the open mouth of another note that is the same, but just a little bit worse, a little bit more terror, a little bit more distant, a little bit more, a little bit more. My Lord, oh Lord, it never stops. I tried to save paper by printing double-sided, which was a bad idea. I don't know. I mean, I'm not opposed to the saving of paper. These poems that are variations on black spirituals, I got this old record of the Fisk Jubilee Singers, and it's so compelling. Like, they don't have a lot of recordings, and so I loved listening to them, and I wrote this series of poems about black spiritual tradition spirituals. Variations on a theme, didn't my Lord deliver Daniel? I asked to be swallowed and never asked to be saved. In any direction the wind blows, it drags you closer to the day of judgment. In every vicious note, the wind stalks the soul, which is a kiss away from becoming ash. Vanity is the ship upon which all other sins set sail. I flex in forgiving light. I know my angles. I age backwards, only child of a wretched season. The sky, weary of the horrible racket made by all our gospels and all our dreaming, rotted with gray, closing in on itself. Still, I'll take it. I have imagined all the ways there are to die, and the mirror says, I survived. Survive them all, too pretty to get gone. I have a memory of the sun catching a stained glass window and spitting the red of a saint's robe onto the concrete where someone had spray painted, I hope all my people find heaven. I have a memory of my grandmother smoking a pack a day and flicking cigarette ash onto a small mirror on her nightstand. The soul makes its own reflection. I swear the storm took everyone except me this time. So pretty, I am left here to nurse the chaos of my loneliness. I did not summon the den or the lion, but I did summon the moan of the vacant heart, which led to my wandering in the dark. No one asked Jonah if there was peace before the panic. For a moment, sharp and thin as the thread between leaving and staying, when inside of the whale he called out, seeking mercy, and what was returned to him was his own voice, the forgiveness he prayed for, stained with red, tucked inside the echo of his prayers. I think I'm gonna read three more poems. This one is another one of those poems, and I can say this now because I think it's out in the world, but and this is a funny story about how no one really understands what writers do or like how long it takes to write anything. I got asked very random. So Sinners is the film, the vampire film, which I think not enough people, who in here has seen Sinners? many of you. I think not enough people talked about how funny that movie was. Like, the vampires were extremely funny. There were, I mean, the white vampires were funny. I think the when it crossed over and we started getting taken, that was significantly less funny to me. But Remick as a character, extremely funny to me. Like, so funny. There's a part where he's just like outside while everyone inside is panicking and fighting for their lives. And he's just like singing and dancing, and he's just out there like aura farming with the rest of the vampires. I loved him. But, well, did I love him? I loved him in theory. In practice, less so. I got asked to write, you know, the Sinners folks hit me up and they were like, we're coming out with a soundtrack on vinyl. We want a book for it. Will you write the book? And I said, sure. By book, because, you know, sometimes people say book and they just mean like a couple pages. I was like, what do you mean by book? And they were like, well, you know, we're thinking like 6,000 words. And I was like, okay, for sure. This call came on a Tuesday. And I said, well, can you give me some direction? Like, what would you like to have written? And they said, of course, anything you want. And I said, well, surely not anything I want, because this is themed. This is like a liner notes, sort of like anything I want. And they're like, anything. And I said, okay. Their only note was like, can you mention the James Blake song on the soundtrack? I was like, for sure. The only white artist on the soundtrack, definitely. Gotcha. Can you highlight James Blake, who I love, respectfully? And I said, okay, anything I want, I guess. And then I said, when do you need this by? And again, this call was on a Tuesday. And I said, Thursday. And I thought, I do write very quickly. I'm a very quick, but they didn't need to know that. And so I called my agent and I was like, make sure they pay me so much money. Tell them that I have to, like, Thursday, that's me and my wife's anniversary. I'm not married. I can't possibly. But nonetheless, I wrote this thing that I love, and it's out now, so you can get the Sinners soundtrack, and there's a really cool book in there that I wrote the most of, and then Jake Blount, who I really like as a musician, they wrote in there, and I think Kugler wrote a thing in there. And one of the things I wrote was a variation on a theme on This Little Light of Mine, because I love the way This Little Light of Mine plays on the soundtrack. Less in the film, but in the soundtrack, it's very haunting. So here's a little poem that you can read this in like 5,800 more words of mine if you get the center soundtrack. Variations on a theme, This Little Light of Mine. On my brother's soul, which shined blue against our bedroom wall the night my mother died, on my beloved elder, who caught the spirit in the front pew, which is one way of saying she became a sky unto herself, heaven casting her own shine, on my mother's grave, which sits so low in the earth it can only be found on a cloudless day, the sun dancing off her shining name, on the gold tooth of the hustler's lover, dulled with a stain of lipstick, which caught the winking eye of the streetlight and turned the broken glass on the sidewalk a red kind of shine, on the blue lights lapping up the black of night and the corner boys praying to survive on the blues and on the lit cigar between a guitar player's knowing grin, on the boys speeding through my block on their bikes and on the shine of the silver handlebars, on their voices thrown into the air, tumbling backwards into a shining echo. The double rim, which causes your jump shot to fall off, has the nerve to shine through a summer's heat, on the hair which left someone you loved before they left you, and on the bathroom sink, which holds on to each strand, even as you try to scrub the shine back into the white, on my father's soul, in the mirror in which our souls try to find each other, on the little light which twins a reflection, the gold shines, but so does the ache of losing it. The homie once tucked a pistol into his pants, and the shine of it made a halo on the concrete, and I told myself he would never die. His casket was open so people could see the gold rings and the necklace and its gaudy cross. You understand it now. All my little light snuffed out and still shines so loud the devil done snuck in. My friend's daughter asked me, what if heaven is the place on fire? Consider the possibility of God as the mosquito gorging itself on your blood until it takes flight, drags itself against the thick and rotting air, red-tipped arrow, messenger spreading the good gospel of your warmth, the good gospel of your still living. Consider the blood nursing the eggs of the mosquito, and consider the mosquito's life, thin as a rail of lightning halving the summer dusk, and consider your mother who once swung a hand into the wind and mumbled, these mosquitoes just love me so much. It's all the same. I was born due to the miracle of someone deciding hoping they would die on God's time and not their own, and I spend a lifetime returning and taking more. The root meaning of the word widow is to be left empty, and if you could return to feed on what nurtured your smallest and most improbable self, my love, wouldn't you? Everyone who could not bear to grow old wanted to become ash. There are no graves. The smoke has nowhere to go but up. I'm going to read one more thing, and then we can talk about whatever you'd like. It's interesting to read this for the first time out loud in Ohio, because I think that people will understand it in a very funny way. So the drive from Columbus to Cincinnati, of course, is one where about a quarter of the way there, so many people say halfway, and that's just not true, but a quarter of the way there, who knows what you pass? Every time I pass that sign, and I would say, I think that content warning that I gave earlier about like orbiting ideas around death and survival is a lot heavier in this poem, but nonetheless, I have a group chat of my dear friends who we've survived ourselves and our worst impulses, and I just text them, hell is real and nothing else. And I've been doing this for years. So if you look at our group chat, there's times where the group chat dries up, as group chats sometimes do, and it's just me being like, hell is real. And then them responding to that, and then me being like, hell is real. And I love that. I love that so much. And there was this moment a couple Halloweens ago with my pal's young daughter, the one who I just read about, wanted to be the devil and a princess simultaneously. And she decided this at like the last minute, you know? Because at first she was like, I don't want to do trick-or-treating this year. And I normally fly to LA, because so many of my friends abandoned Columbus for LA, my old punk friends. And I go to, every year I fly to LA to go trick-or-treating with their kids, which is so wild and beautiful to me. I get to be like a freelance uncle, you know? And his daughter was like, I don't want to go trick-or-treating this year. And I was like, cool, you know what I mean? We just kick it in LA then, I guess. You know, I'm up for, let's see a show. And then the morning before trick-or-treating, she was like, I would like to be the devil and Elsa. And I thought, ooh, let's make it happen, you know what I mean? And so I really, this poem means a lot to me, and I think I'd like to close with it before we do questions and talk, because I love this group of friends so deeply, and the fact that we have survived long enough to be parents and freelance uncles and, you know, grown-ups, it seemed so improbable, like 20, 15 years ago. And so thank y'all for listening to the poems that I read, and I'll close with this one. Every time I pass the sign, I send a text to the group chat of my friends who didn't die. Hell is real and nothing else, and everyone falls in line. The one who took the wrong pills to overdose, but the right pills to sleepwalk, delirious down Kenny Road, mumbling 80s pop songs, texts, it gets more real by the day. The one who still jokes about how she couldn't drown herself in her childhood bathtub because it was too shallow, texts, yes, it is, and it is a pickup line at my kid's elementary school. The one who locked himself in a closet to drown out the song of the goldfinch through his open window and could not tolerate a gun going off being the last living sound he heard, texts, I cannot wait until we all find each other there. The one who we pulled from the river, the one we carried out of the alley where someone had scrawled, my heart is a match lit by the Lord, next to the dumpster, the one who pressed a crystal into my palm 2 years ago and kissed the back of my hand and told me we are more inevitable than time itself. That one, he begins listing all the people we will encounter in hell, all the people who will make a mess of our otherwise joyful reunion, the developers who tore down the punk house, Phil Spector, every American president, and the one who stepped back from the bridge because below, someone was on a boat shouting, hold on to that feeling while roaming into the vacant and starless black text that the sign is too pretty now, too famous, hell, the glamorous destination, opulent afterlife sold to the highest bidder, and the friend who, years ago, carried me out of my own bed and placed me in front of a window that was open and facing the sunset and said, some things have no good reason to return, but they do. He texts, y'all remember this, and sends a photo of his daughter, who, last trick-or-treat, wanted to be the devil and also a princess at the same time, and at 11 p.m., the night before Halloween, we all piled in his car and drove around Los Angeles, running through every store looking for a crown, and then a cape, and then bright red paint, and then the candy aisle. I acted like I was going to steal handfuls, like I used to do in the old days, putting packs of M&Ms in my jacket pockets until they spilled onto the carpet, and I fell, laughing, into the arms of the one who has scars on each side of her knee, that looked like 2/16 notes, because once she leapt from a building too small to kill her but big enough to break every bone in her left leg. And in the hospital, the doctor said the name for the scenario, which, on the way to killing you, instead drops you off early at the doorway to prolonged suffering, is called the devil's sweet spot, which is also a name for what we were seeking that night in a garage in Los Angeles, tinting a cheap gold crown with red spray paint and our shirts over our faces, walking through the gleaming red clouds, which are as thin as scattered ashes, thin as the smoke from a candle at the end of a child's wish, which is always a wish for more time, always a wish for a future dressed up in the costume of something else, a new dog, a new dress, to one day see snow and the sunlight scattering across it, never finding out how close you were to being gone, to never being at all. Look at us, faithful flock, what we've made of our mistakes in miracles. We place the crown on your daughter's head, and we place the pitchfork in her hands, in our hearts, which keep going, our hearts, which dragged us through and beyond the crisis of our own desires. Our hearts belong to her. They are the decoration on the walls of every hell she can imagine.
You've been listening to Think Twice on WYSO, today featuring writer Hanif Abdurraqib, recorded at the Foundry Theater in Yellow Springs in September of 2025. To learn more about Abdurraqib, his books, and to track his in-person appearances, visit abdurraqib.com. Special thanks to Chris Westhoff, director of the Foundry Theater and managing director of Mad River Theater Works. For Think Twice on WYSO, I'm Dave Barber. Thanks for listening.